Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
What came next is intended for mature audiences only. Episodes discuss topics that can be triggering, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, animal abuse, suicide, and murder. I am not a therapist, nor am I a doctor. If you're in need of support, please visit somethingwaswrong.com/resources for a list of nonprofit organizations that can help. Opinions expressed by my guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of myself or Broken Cycle Media. Resources and source material are linked in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening. Mike Sachs is a hockey player, telecommunications engineer, founder of the nonprofit organization Survivors for Change, and a true change maker. Through Survivors for Change, it has become Mike's personal mission to aid survivors of sexual abuse and assault in their journey of healing, alongside Kelly G, whose story has also been featured in What Came Next, episodes 51 and 52. But before Mike was able to begin helping others, he had to come to terms with his own abuse and begin healing from his childhood experiences. In the following episodes, Mike candidly shares about his struggles, the healing process, and what it's like traversing the media in an attempt to improve procedures in the athletic world. The Broken Cycle Media team is deeply grateful for Mike's time, energy, and the ability to amplify his efforts towards curating change for athletes all over the world.
Hello, my name is Michael Sachs. I live in Hickory Hills, Illinois, which is about 25 miles from downtown Chicago in the southwest suburbs. When I was very, very young, probably 4 years old, my dad built an ice rink in the backyard. I don't remember this, but my dad said he put the skates on me, he put me on the ice, and then he was going to go put his skates on and come out there with me. And I was skating around already. He didn't even have to teach me how to skate. That's where my love for hockey came, was from my backyard. I remember going to the ice rink for the first time with my dad. They were building an ice rink down here on the south side. I remember walking in there 4 or 5 years old, holding my dad's hand. And I played on the first house league team out of that arena. That's where I started taking skating lessons. It was fun. When I grew up, this was the 70s, there was no internet. So I had two sets of friends. I had my friends from school, and then I had my friends from hockey. It was a great life. I loved playing hockey. The one thing I didn't like too much was when my dad became my coach. That wasn't fun for me. Dad could be pretty vicious. He used to like to make me cry in front of all the other players. He would do nasty things, like make me skate more than the other kids. I remember one time we were playing in a tournament. I got a penalty, and my dad jumped into the penalty box and put me up against the wall and said, I can't do nothing to the other kids, but I can kill you if I want to. All because I got a penalty. I was like 8 or 9 years old at the time. You can't do that to kids. There was another time I just told my dad I didn't want to play summer hockey. I wanted to take the summer off. And the next thing, my dad just went nuts in the car, started punching the ceiling of the car. So that wasn't all that fun for me. But hockey always was, because once I got on the ice, I was in charge. I was the one who was making the decisions on where I would pass the puck. I was the one playing. It wasn't him. He was in charge of everything else. Essentially, he was living through his son, is what it was. My father was a really good athlete. He had a tryout with the Detroit Tigers when he was 17 years old, and his father wouldn't let him go. My grandfather was a really good baseball player as well, but he was vicious to my father. And I didn't find this out until after my father died. My father used to pretty much get the crap beat out of him every day by his father. That affected my dad, obviously. How can it not? I was an aggressive kid because I was always pissed off at my father. So I would go out on the ice and I would take it out on somebody else's kid. I don't know if my father was doing that on purpose. I've often thought, was my father raising a son or was he trying to raise an athlete? He wanted his son to play professional hockey. My dad's the one who decided what team I was going to play on. He even decided what equipment I was going to wear. This was a classic case of somebody living through their kid. That's why I say he was raising an athlete, not a son. When I was a freshman in high school, I had a party at my house. And my parents were home. They knew what was going on. And one of my buddies, he got pretty drunk. And he came over the next day to apologize. And my mom came walking in the kitchen and she's like, oh, so-and-so was really drunk last night. And I just kind of was like, Mom, shut up. He's apologizing right now. But I did tell my mom to shut up. And that night when I got home, my father came running up the stairs from the basement. He grabbed me and he threw me over the stove and he put a knife to my throat. He goes, I'll kill you. I thought I was going to die. I thought finally this man just snapped and he was going to kill me. I still remember that. I could still feel that knife on my throat. Man was vicious. My dad, he never hit me, but it was always the punch that never came. He would act like he was going to hit you, but he didn't hit you. But it's still the same psychological damage that's done to a kid. Maybe even worse because you're waiting for it. He just bullied his own family, which is probably what he learned from his father. They had that drill sergeant mentality raising a kid, treating somebody else like crap, call it tough love. It's abuse is what it is. It always felt like it was my mom and dad and my three sisters against me. I was always the outsider. Probably not so much my youngest sister because there's 11 or 12 years between us. So I wasn't really close with her. It was torture. I understand what happened to him, but he did that to me and I don't do that to other people. My father used to say life's about choices and he chose to do what he did to a little kid. So he's got to own that. My father just completely destroyed my boundaries. Put a kid into fight or flight mode is what he did. I've been in fight or flight mode since I was a kid. My breakout year was when I was 15 years old. That's when the scouts really started coming. That year, I was just playing hockey. We started traveling and then I started getting a lot of attention. I was a sophomore in high school. The colleges weren't coming around, but there would be OHL scouts, which is up in Canada, the Ontario Hockey League. You'd go play in a Silver Stick tournament and all those guys would be there. So that was the first time scouts were asking about me. And that's also the year I met Chico. Chico was our coach. Chico was my abuser. When I was 15 years old, I played hockey for the Budweiser Jets. Chico was the coach of that team. Then the following year, I was 16 years old, and Chico asked if I wanted to play on a junior team that he was putting together. And that was a big opportunity for me because not a lot of 16-year-olds get to play juniors. So that was a big feather in my cap. And we actually won nationals that year. Chico was a hell of a coach. There's no doubt about that. He was also a pretty good pedophile, too. At 16 years old, I was going to a Catholic high school here in Chicago, Mount Carmel, which I didn't want to leave Mount Carmel, but I had to because practice was starting at 1:30 in the afternoon, and I had to get out of school early to go to hockey practice. My junior year of high school, the first quarter of that year, I went to the local high school, and I stayed there for a quarter. Things just weren't going well. I didn't like school. Chico was starting to say, oh, it's his friends. My friends were bad. I found out later that that's one of the things that these pedophiles do, and that's to isolate you. They get rid of your friends. Back then, they had a work program at school where you can go to school in the morning and then you go to work after school. So you'd go to school from like 8 to 12 and then you were off. Well, my work was going to hockey practice. I had a really, really good year. The scouts were going pretty much crazy for me. That summer, I was drafted by the Windsor Spitfires into the OHL. And I wanted to go there, but my dad didn't want me to go there. So my father made Chico my legal guardian, which I still can't believe he did that to this day. We went to court and everything on it. And then I lived up at that house in Lisle, Illinois. There were other players living in the house. There was about six hockey players there. I was the youngest. I was handed over to him on a silver platter. He knew I hated my father. So he knew that there's no way I was going to go to my father. I'm the one that told Chico all the stuff my dad used to do to me. So all Chico had to do was become what my father wasn't. I was the type of kid that these predators look for. I was textbook what these guys look for. They look for abuse at home, and then they just hone in on it. The parent then is the target, and the kid's the prize. And that's what happened. Not only was I groomed, my parents were groomed for this. Chico would start taking you out to dinners, and then he would start talking about sex. Then he would take you downtown Chicago, and you would drive around and look for prostitutes. But he wouldn't get one for you. It was just always sex, sex, sex. I realized now he was just desensitizing me to it. And then that's when I was propositioned one night going home. He told me he knew this girl and that a bunch of guys that he played hockey with at College of DuPage knew this girl from the University of Illinois, Chicago Circle. He called her Sheila, and she used to like to give blowjobs, but she was sexually abused at one point, and so you would have to be blindfolded. I was 16, I fell for it. And then it turned out it was him. I want people to understand how this happens. The grooming process lasted for 14 months, and that was before Chico became my legal guardian. And then after that, that was 22 more months of him abusing the shit out of me. People are probably going to say, how do you let somebody do that to you? But it's not like it happens overnight. They wear you down and you don't even realize it's happening. This had gone on for 22 months, probably 35 times, 40 times, maybe more. I mean, he was my legal guardian. He was a friend to me. Because of him, at least I thought, all these scouts were coming around and looking at me. I was starting to get all this attention, and I had never gotten that before. After we won nationals, I still had another year. I was the youngest kid on the team. Everybody was seniors. I was a junior in high school. All of those guys were going on to college. So we had to find a place for me to play. The team we had beat for nationals, the St. Paul Vulcans, I was going to go play for them next year. I graduated high school in 1985. So I did my senior year of high school up in Minnesota. I was like, okay, great. I'm going to get away from Chico. And at this point, I still didn't know it was him. I still thought this was a girl. Me and Chico were just buds, and we had a little secret there. We had this girl coming over. I was ready to get away from Chico. And then he got the assistant coach job at the University of Minnesota. And I was like, oh my God, my father had me live with him. So now I was back in this and I couldn't get out of it. So then that summer, I went to the Olympic Training Center out in Colorado Springs. So I was out there for that, had a really good camp. And Chico was out there scouting, actually, for the University of Minnesota. He was maybe 3 weeks on the job. We flew home together afterwards. Chico was driving me down to my parents' home on the south side. And on the way home, he said, Sheila's coming over tonight. And I said, no, I said, I've been gone for 2 weeks. I want to hang out with my friends. And then that's when the first time he turned on me. And that's when he yelled and he goes, I do everything for you. That's the least you could do for me. His whole thing was he always needed me to do it because she wouldn't do it if it was just him. So I did it. It was just a total guilt job, but I fell for it. And Chico knew what he was doing. There was one night in the spring of 1985. We were up in Minnesota and he said, Sheila's coming over. And I said, no, I said, I'm not doing it. I just didn't want to. I felt dirty. I wasn't going to do it anymore. And he knew I was serious. So then he tried guilting me. He's like, well, that's fine. I'll just get some of the guys from the university to do it. And I'm like, fine, go ahead. I don't give a fuck what you do. So then he left and he went to the university. I remember this night. He was in a panic when he got back. Like something happened. I knew something happened. Obviously, he didn't tell me what happened, but I found out about 35 years later, he was doing this all year to these guys at Minnesota. A couple of the players did a sting operation that night and they caught him. Those guys were in a bar one night and one of the guys that this happened to, he had said something to the other guys and one of the upperclassmen came by. He's like, this isn't right. So they all got together. Wherever it was they were staying, these guys went and they staked out the entrances. So they had one guy call and agreed to do that with Chico. So Chico came over. The guys were outside looking to see who came in the house. And it was only Chico that went in. And then that's when they went to the athletic director. And that's how Chico lost his job. Those guys are my heroes. I thought when I read that report 35 years later, I couldn't believe it. And then I knew right away that was the night I said I wasn't going to do it anymore. This was a scandal up at the University of Minnesota. I was supposed to be a freshman. They offered me a full scholarship. And this dirtbag calls me up, a 17-year-old kid, mind you. I was still a minor at this time. And this guy called me up and said, Mike, we don't think you should come to the University of Minnesota. And I said, why not? And he said, because of the sexual allegations against Chico. And I said, what does that have to do with me? And he said, Mike, there's going to be a lot of reporters and a lot of questions. I knew hockey was over because I was afraid if something like this ever came out in a locker room, you'd get the crap beat out of you pretty bad. This is the mid-80s. So that's when I asked to get out of my scholarship. I had nowhere to go play hockey then next year. So I was going to go to Bowling Green University then because I was offered a scholarship there or to the University of Maine. One of those two places is where I should have ended up. The coach at Bowling Green, he got me a tryout with the Ottawa 67s, which is in the OHL. I was in camp with Ottawa for the 85-86 season. The coach told me I made the team. I had to see if I had the game, if I could make the team. And I did make the team. So I was proud of that. But I told the team that I didn't want to play. I was going to go home. Hockey's over with. I went home. I didn't put that hockey equipment on for another 25 years after that. I didn't want my dad to pick me up at the airport. Believe it or not, I had Chico pick me up at the airport. And he drove me home. When I got home, I went to bed. It was kind of late. The next day, when my dad got home from work, he walked downstairs and he said, you want to know what it's like in the real world? Get the fuck out of my house. When I quit hockey, he wanted nothing to do with me. I don't believe it that I quit hockey. I view it more as I was ran out of hockey. But I went into my Aunt Patricia's house, and she gave me a bed to sleep in. My Aunt Patricia has always been there for me. She's like my mother. Every time I get in trouble or if I need something, she's the person I go to. She's just always been there for me. She's just an amazing human being. If it wasn't for her and my Uncle Eugene, I don't know where I would have ended up. I think those two people were extremely significant, even more so than I realized at the time. I'm just now actually seeing it when I look back on how much those two really, really saved me. After I walked away from hockey, my Uncle Eugene is probably the closest thing I had to a father figure. He owned a construction company, so I went and I started serving my carpenter's apprenticeship. I was building homes with him. When I'm working construction, you start at 7, you get off at 3:30. There's times I'm up all night. I can't sleep more than 4 hours. I'm suffering from trauma, but I'm suffering in silence. You miss work, and then you look like you're lazy. Nobody knows, and it just looks like I don't want to go to work, but it's not true. I got this thing going on inside that's messing with me. When I was in my 20s, I had told my parents what happened. I was shit-faced drunk one night, and I came home probably 2 a.m, and I went up and I told my mom, go get my dad up, and I told him what happened. I wanted to go after the people that did this, and my parents just sat there at the kitchen table, and they were really quiet, and they were just looking at each other. I got the message. This would have been really embarrassing to them, and I was to keep my mouth shut. At least that's what I took out of that. And so I never did anything then. If I would have, I could have saved people from getting hurt, and I didn't. And I still regret that to this day. In my case, I actually know the survivors that got hurt after me. That's a hard thing to live with. I definitely started self-medicating and drinking heavily. I was basically just working to pay my cover charge for the party. I would get my paycheck on Friday. By Monday, I was broke because I spent everything on drugs. I realized now what I was doing. You're trying to make the pain go away, but that doesn't work. So then I bounced around. It was really hard because you see all your friends are moving on with their life, but I was stuck spinning my wheels. I couldn't move forward because of what happened to me. Then I met Anya, who's my wife. That was the first time I ever really put somebody else before me, if you will. I was tired of the partying. That was all getting old. I wanted to try to move forward. We settled in. I don't have any kids. That just didn't work for us. I threw my back out at work and I was laying at home and I kept seeing these commercials on TV for DeVry. And I'm like, fuck it, I'm going back to school. In my second semester, I met somebody at school. He's like, give me your resume. So I gave him my resume and 2 weeks later, I was working at Nextel. I had gotten out of construction. I was a 30-year-old intern. I loved it. And that's really when things started to turn around for me. When I lost hockey, it was like losing a part of yourself. I had to go try to find something that I loved second best and make it the thing that I loved first, if that makes sense. I was lucky I found Nextel. I put everything I had into that. I don't have a college degree, and I ended up being a telecommunications engineer. They brought me over into engineering because I was pretty good at it. I had a knack for it. If there was a night where I couldn't sleep, I could just get dressed and go to work, and they would see the work I got done. My bosses were great with it. So that worked out for me, but I was having blackouts. I was losing time. I worked in downtown Chicago. I was walking downtown. I was putting up like 15, 20 miles a day just walking the loop. And the next thing I knew, I was in Grant Park standing in front of the Bean. And I don't remember getting there. That freaks you out. And it happened to me another time. I was on the Riverwalk when I came to, and I was like, how the hell did I get here? I was just walking and processing. It was really scary. I was actually at work in a meeting. That's when I got that flashback of when my father jumped into the penalty box. I had forgotten about that. And then it just popped into my head in the middle of the meeting. I went into panic. And then I couldn't get out of the meeting. So I'm sitting there and I'm literally freaking out because I could see the scorekeeper. That's how vivid it was. And it just devastated me. The silence is like an incubator. It keeps building in your own brain because you're embarrassed to say anything. Throughout my 20s up until my 40s, you're like, did he do that to me? Nobody would do that. So you're going back and like, you're still uncertain. What happened? I did that then for 20 years. You still think about it. It's the first thing you think about every morning when you wake up, and the last thing you think about when you go to sleep is what happened to you. You never get rid of this. You just learn to manage it as best you can. That's what these pedophiles do. They're serial killers. They genuinely are. They kill a part of who you are and they make you live with it. Sandusky, that sent me over the edge. Jerry Sandusky, he was the assistant coach at Penn State University. He was sexually molesting kids. Joe Paterno, he knew and he didn't say anything. That was a big problem back then, is the coaches didn't say anything. Everybody swept this under the rug. That opened up some wounds. I think at that point is when I finally admitted this is what happened to me. I tried going into some therapy then, but it's so hard to find a therapist for male sexual abuse. There was nowhere to go, so I had to go to a woman's rape center where I went and got therapy. I had to walk in there and there was all these women and they were looking at me. They were probably so uncomfortable that a man was there, but yet I was there to get help too because I was starting to lose it again. This really affected me. 2011, I went to therapy. I found a pretty good therapist and then she was leaving to go into the Peace Corps. So I just kind of dropped it. I didn't go back to therapy for a while until probably about 6 or 7 years ago. It was in 2018. I had met up with a bunch of friends that I hadn't seen in 28 years. One of the guys I actually played hockey with, he was on the national championship team with Chico. He knew what happened to me because I had told him. So that night, he had pulled me aside. We were talking about Chico, and he goes, Chris Jensen got him, ran out of hockey. And I said, no, he didn't. He's still coaching. And I didn't know who Chris was then. Chris was the one who kept Chico out of the Illinois Hockey Hall of Fame. They wanted to put Chico in there, and God bless Chris. He's like, nope, not on my watch. And Chris was the first one that came forward. He wrote a letter and sent it to the Amateur Hockey Association of Illinois, and he told them what happened. The next morning, then, I'm like, I got to talk to Chris. So then I asked my buddy, I'm like, look, can you set up a call between me and Chris? And so he did. I'll never forget, I talked to Chris. Chris is like, can you tell me what happened? I got to make sure. And I'm like, okay. So I got into it and I told him about the blindfold. He goes, stop right there. He goes, I'm so sorry this happened to you. And I go, I'm sorry this happened to you too. That was the first time it really hit me. I'm like, holy shit, this happened to me. This really, really happened. And then I got angry. I got protective of the kids because Chris is a year younger than me. So I was like, if I would have came forward, nothing would have happened to Chris. Nothing would have happened to all these other guys. I didn't know about Kelly then, but I knew there had to be other victims. If it was me and Chris, then there's more. Me and Chris were talking, and then Chris helped me write my letter. Chico was coaching at Robert Morris University here in Chicago. So I was going to send my letter to the school, and then I was going to send it to the conference that they play in, the ACHA. I sent it to Robert Morris and to the ACHA. All hell broke loose. There was a woman from the university that called me. She was like the VP of HR, and she was a hockey mom. At this point, this is the first time I'm saying any of this stuff out loud, and that's not an easy thing to do. And I'm saying it to a woman. I was a complete basket case at this point. So then SafeSport called me, and I didn't know anything about SafeSport. I didn't know who SafeSport was.
As the U.S. Center for SafeSport website explains, their organization is, quote, authorized by Congress to help abuse prevention, education, and accountability take root in every sport, on every court, end quote. Their organization offers specific interventions like direct training programs, audit and compliance processes, and they investigate abuse and misconduct reports.
Around November of 2018, I have my SafeSport interview. That was 5.5 hours long. It was just grueling because you got to tell everything. I'm sitting there and I'm saying it to these women, what happened to me. I just completely broke down. I was really, really upset and embarrassed and mad at myself. Like, how could you let somebody do this to you? About 40 minutes left in the interview and my phone starts blowing up. My dad died in the middle of my interview. I remember just thinking to myself, you ran out on me again. The ladies from SafeSport, when I told them what happened to me, they looked at me and they said, we're doing the paperwork on this right now. He is suspended. When I was doing my report, we had to stop because I was a minor and I was brought across state lines. That's sex trafficking. I was trafficked at that point. They brought the FBI in then to ask them questions, and they were like, no, it's still the statute of limitations you're up against. So then they started the investigation. That took probably 8 months. So I just got on with my life. Then my SafeSport report actually kicked off another SafeSport report into a guy named Jimmy Smith. Jimmy Smith was the president of USA Hockey. It wasn't until a buddy of mine, Larry, had cancer when he was younger and he lost part of his leg. So Larry has had adversity in his life. He was just so grounded. He sat me down and he just said, Michael, he goes, look what you just admitted. You got to stop making decisions. You're too erratic right now. You got to let this thing pass through you. That was probably the best advice I got early on, was from Larry. You got to sit with this. You're worried that people are going to find out, but I'm like, no, nobody's going to find out. It's not in the papers. It was just, I wrote the letter. If people in hockey know it's me, I don't really give a shit because I'm not around hockey anymore at that point. Then one night I came home from work and I get this phone call, and it's Katie Strang from The Athletic. Katie's like, is this Mike Sachs? And I said, yes. She said, I want to ask you a question, and this is going to seem a little odd. Do you know a Tom Chico Atratis? And I was like, boom, click. I hung up on her. I went into complete panic. I think I shot her a text, and I'm like, I'm sorry I hung up on you. Can I call you? Or something like that. We talked on the phone. She asked me point blank, and I said, I want to tell my story. I have to. I can't live with this anymore.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Next week on What Came Next.
Katie had started telling me that she has this other survivor. She goes, he's not in good shape. But she couldn't tell me his name because she had to keep the integrity of the story. So I knew there was this kid that was hurting. I didn't know his name. I didn't know where he lived. I just knew I had to get to him.
What Came Next is a Broken Cycle Media production, co-produced by Amy B. Chesler and Tiffany Reese. If you'd like to help support What Came Next, you can leave us a positive review, support our sponsors, or follow Broken Cycle Media on Instagram at Broken Cycle Media. Check out the episode notes for sources, resources, and to follow our guests. Thank you again for listening.